clock on the wall is a little bit fast, so people sit down 2 minutes early, and then there's this awkward do you start or do you not start thing. We are continuing for the rest of the time that Tom is gone, continuing Deuteronomy on Wednesday nights. Of course, next Wednesday will be the first Wednesday of the month, so we'll have our singing service. But otherwise, I think there'll be one or two more Deuteronomy classes after this one on Wednesday night, then back to Galatians with him, and this will be relegated, it's not the word I'm looking for, but we'll be back on Sundays only for the duration after that point. So this does give us the opportunity to slow down a little bit more. If you have the schedule that I made a while back, we are supposed to be well beyond this point by now, but since we've got a few Wednesday nights, I figured I'd slow down, and in particular in this section, where it is much more rich, I think, than some of the later laws, that we should be able to move through a little bit more quickly, give us the chance to slow down here. We've had a couple of chapters with very good chapter breaks. You didn't expect it to last forever. So today we're going to look at chapter 9 and the very beginning of chapter 10, which is a continuation of the thought up to that point. So that's what we're going to be talking about this evening. Let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for this opportunity that we have to come together as your people to encourage one another and to give ourselves to your word and the study of it. We ask that you would lay us bare before your sight as your sword of your word pierces us and divides us, that we would see who we are, that we would make the changes that we need to make in relation to it. In your Son we pray. Amen. Well, Deuteronomy chapter 9 is the beginning of this third section, and I've got my reference wrong there. The beginning of this third section of Moses' second sermon here. We've been talking about kind of the foundation of the covenant relationship, the essence of the covenant relationship. Now here we are at the grace of the covenant relationship, wrapping up these kind of fundamental principles of the covenant. And then that's going to continue on through the rest of chapter 11, which will be another section. And then in chapter 12 and following are some of the details of the covenant with the law itself. So we've seen this plenty of times. This is just kind of the next stage along the way of that outlining. Now, you may remember the last two chapters, chapter 7 and 8, had that nice concentric structure that worked its way to a middle point and then back in reverse order. This chapter does not do that. This chapter is doing something a little bit different. This is the chapter where Moses, in a couple of places, has a hypothetical sparring partner, verbal sparring partner. Interlocutor is the word, but I don't want to use that word, so I won't say it. So-and-so would say such a thing is the idea, and then he refutes that. He rebuts that is the idea. And so he's working through these hypothetical sorts of assertions about the nation of Israel and arguing against it. If there is something of a structural clue in chapter 9 and into chapter 10 as well, it is the phrase 40 days and 40 nights. This phrase, 40 days and 40 nights, shows up 9 times in the entire Old Testament. 5 of those 9 occurrences are in this section of the text. That's a pretty significant percentage of a phrase to show up, which tells you something's going on. And in fact, what happens is there are events as Moses is responding to one of these assertions. There are events as Moses is retelling the history, and this phrase shows up at key moments that drive the story forward. So, for example, in verse 9, when I went up to the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant the Lord made with you, I remained on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. And so for God to give the Ten Commandments to Moses is ultimately this little section of the text, verses 9 and 10. And there was this 40 day and 40 night period that Moses was on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments from God. And then in verse 11, it shows up again after that. At the end of 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord gave me two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, arise, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you have brought from Egypt have acted corruptly. And all the way down to verse 17 is this next section over this 40 day and 40 night period. That's how long it took for Israel to get involved in this heinous sin of the golden calf. And we'll talk about the details of this text in a little while. And then in verse 18, you have the next occurrence of this. Then I lay prostrate before the Lord as before, 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all the sin that you've committed in doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. And so for Moses to deal with the sin, which was in terms of his fasting here, but then not just that, but making intercession for Aaron even, but not just that, destroying the golden calf. So in a variety of ways of dealing with the sin, there was this 40 day and 40 night period. And then Moses also is going to intercede for them. So I lay prostrate before the Lord for these 40 days. It's the same 40 day and 40 night period, but again, it's introducing this next section. And this is going to be the section that's dealing specifically with Moses' intercessory prayer for the Israelites. Again, marked by this 40 day and 40 night section that runs all the way through 10:5. As far as this goes, we'll talk about verses 6 through 9 of chapter 10, which is a little bit of an oddity later on. But then in verse 10, I myself stayed on the mountain as the first time, 40 days and 40 nights, as the Lord listened to me that night also. And so he is now, you know, completing this period of atonement, completing the process, getting the new tablets of stone. And then at the end of the beginning of verse 11, the Lord says, arise, go on your journey. And so the tablets of stone are back in their possession again, and God is again directing them to go to the promised land. And so atonement has been made, their task is going to be renewed. And so at each key point, this statement is kind of driving the story forward. So this is your closest thing to a structural clue to this chapter. It's not exactly the same sort of thing we've seen in the past. Charlie? Oh yes, absolutely. I think so. The fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. It's not as clear as Israel being in the wilderness for 40 years being parallel to Jesus 40 days and 40 nights, because there you've got Israel failing and Jesus succeeding. But Jesus as this model intercessor for his people. And you pick that up in Hebrews as well. Moses was faithful in the household, and you've got this Jesus-Moses kind of comparison. It's maybe not as clear of a specific sort of foreshadowing, but there certainly is a flavor of that here, I think. Yeah, and again, it's kind of hard to pin down exactly because the New Testament never comes out and makes that explicitly clear like it does in some places. But it's noteworthy, I think, that after Jesus 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, he ascends the mountain and begins the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel, which is not exactly a new law, but at the same time, there's enough similarities, I think, that you can make a conceptual comparison between, I mean, in Matthew in particular, you've got this crazy king killing all the babies, just like Pharaoh. You've got the flight to Egypt, and out of Egypt I call my son, which is a direct reference to a passage that's talking about the Exodus in its original context. You've got the 40 days in the wilderness where he's tempted and succeeds, quoting the book of Deuteronomy, and then you've got the right. And the Beatitudes heading off the Sermon on the Mount, the way the Decalogue heads off this covenant. I mean, it seems to be an intentional sort of conceptual parallel. But again, of all the places, I mean, Matthew is the gospel that most frequently says, this was done to fulfill that which was written by. Matthew never makes it explicit. And so he kind of leaves it there for you to ponder, probably more than for us to say, yes, this is absolutely, definitely, 100%, you know, I don't think you can miss it. I think it's there, but of all people not to be explicit, Matthew's not explicit about it. So that's a kind of surprising thing. All right, well, let's get into this text then. And it begins with this false claim. Really, there are a couple here at the beginning. Hear, O Israel. And remember, that's kind of the phrase that marks off these three different sections of this beginning part of the sermon. Hear, O Israel, you are to cross over the Jordan today to go in and to dispossess the nations greater and mightier than you, cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know, and of whom you have heard it was said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? Know therefore today that he who goes over before you as a consuming fire is the Lord your God. He will destroy them and subdue them before you. So you shall drive them out and make them perish quickly, as the Lord has promised you. Do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess this land, and it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess this land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you, that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people. And so Moses is not pulling any punches here, but the false claim, and this is the third of these such boasts. We saw the first one back in chapter 7 in verses 6 through 10. It's not because you're more number than any of the other people that God set his love on you and chose you. It's not because you're so great, that you're the greatest nation, and that's why God chose you. And then chapter 8, you know, my might and the power of my hand has gotten me this wealth. No, it's not because of your power that you have gotten this land and these things. And now it's not because you're righteous that God is driving out the Canaanites. And in response to this, he depicts what is the reality of the situation instead. And those are the two citations that I just made reference to on the screen now, a click behind. But the reality of the situation is that, in fact, they can't do it. They are, in fact, too weak to take the land. That's where it begins. They are greater and mightier than you. They are great and fortified up to heaven. Which is an interesting thing for Moses to say, because this is almost verbatim what the spies said when they came back with a bad report. And you see that back in chapter 1 and verse 28. But the point here is, on one level, they were right. We are not strong enough to take this land. But you see, the thing is, it's not about our strength. That's sort of the point. It's not about our strength. It's the fact that our God is a consuming fire who goes before us. And we've seen that phrase already as well in chapter 4 and in chapter 5, that God is a consuming fire. And in those places, it's about the judgment of God being poured out even on his own people. Or the fire of God at Mount Sinai that was devouring and frightening them. And now God is saying, that's going to be poured out on these people that are your enemies. I will go before you and I will be a consuming fire before you to clear the way so that you can be victorious. And in fact, it is because it's God's victory that they have any hope of victory at all. Yet what Moses foresees is that in spite of it being God's victory, they will claim moral superiority over all the Canaanites. And this was a pretty common thing in the ancient world, where the gods were seen to be going to war as nations went to war. And an element of that quite frequently was not just whose god was stronger, but who is the right nation and who is the wrong nation in a moral, ethical sort of way of looking at things. And the nation that won was the righteous nation. Was a very common way of looking at things in the ancient Near East. And so for them to slip into thinking this would have been pretty expected in an ancient context. And so God makes it clear, no, you are in fact too unrighteous to take the land. It's not your righteousness that is behind you taking the land. It is instead their wickedness that leads them to be driven out. And more than that, because God is faithful to his promises. We saw this back again in chapter 7. God didn't choose you because you were the greatest people, but because he was faithful to his promises, because he was faithful to the oath. And now the same thing is coming up again. He is being faithful to his promises to the forefathers, and it is in spite of your stubbornness in verse 6. And here, a lot of translations will render this with the more literal stiff-necked, which is... it's an image of someone trying to drive an ox that doesn't want to go the direction that he's supposed to go. He won't, he won't submit to the yoke, or a horse who won't submit to the reins. And if you've ever been on the back of a horse that won't submit to the reins, you realize how strong of an animal it can be when it is stiff-necked against what you're trying to do. And that's what this analogy, this image is coming from. And you people are stiff-necked. I'm trying to drive you in a certain direction, and you fight against me at every turn, is the idea of that. Greg? Yeah, and I mean, you think of some of the people that Jesus goes up against, and you know, the absurdity to which they take that. You know, we're Abraham's descendants. We've never been enslaved to anybody. Well, I mean, you know, other than the Egyptians and the Syrians and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and other than all of those people, they've never been enslaved to anybody. But that kind of pride in your ancestry certainly is something. And so, all of this really is saying that it's God's grace that is bringing you to this land. It has nothing to do with your own self-attributed righteousness. The Canaanites' wickedness doesn't mean that you're righteous. The fact that you are God's agent of justice does not mean that you're righteous. This is the exact same thing that Habakkuk's going to run into he says, God, you need to do something about the wickedness here. And he goes, oh, I am. I'm bringing the Chaldeans. They're going to wipe you all out. And wait a second. That's not what I had in mind. They're more wicked than we are. And God says, yeah, they are wicked. And I'm going to judge them too. They're being used as an agent of God's justice doesn't mean they're righteous. The same thing is true with the Israelites here. Just because they're being used as God's agent of justice doesn't mean that they're righteous either. So they might think they're righteous, but they're not. And so all of this is to really drive that point home. Any thoughts here on the first six verses? Yeah, Stephen? The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You will not make an end of them at once. 9:3. Know therefore that he who goes over before you is a consuming fire, is the Lord your God. He will destroy them and subdue them before you. So you shall drive them out and make them perish quickly, as the Lord your God has promised you. The quickly versus little by little. That's a good question. I think that some of it, you remember when we were talking about... The problem of, you know, the Canaanite genocide, as it's called sometimes, and there is this ancient Near Eastern warfare language that kind of exaggerates a little bit. I hesitate to say that 9:3 is that exactly, but the way of talking about it in such a way that says this is going to be an easy thing for you to do because God is leading your way, I don't think that idea that this is going to be easy because God is fighting for you is necessarily contradictory with it's actually going to happen slowly over an extended period of time. That may be one way of thinking about it. Jonathan?
Is it possible to distinguish between the entire project of conquering the whole land versus individual victories?
Yeah, that's maybe another distinction.
It may have taken
right. So Jericho was conquered in a week, for example, which is a quick conquering of that city, but not necessarily the entire thing. So that may be something to consider as well. Thank you. All right. Well, the rest of chapter 9 is Moses' rebuttal of this hypothetical situation. He's already given a little bit of a rebuttal of it, but now he's going to get into some detail. He started by saying, "No, you're not righteous. You're stubborn, and they're wicked." But now is when he's really getting into the heart of this. And this does have something of a structural clue around this. It's one of those inclusios, it is called, where you've got the same phrase on either end of a section of text, kind of bracketing the whole thing. And it's an inverse inclusio, too. So we do have our ABBA for people that get excited by that. So, and this first section is all about the golden calf. And this is the way that it's marked, and I've just got it in italic and bold to distinguish between the two sections of the sentence. From the day that you came out of the land of Egypt until you have come to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord, there at the end of 9:7. And then in verse 24, you have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. And so it's the exact same idea. It's verbatim in a few places, not the entire verse. Where it's different is from the day I knew you versus from the day you came out of the land of Egypt. But both of those are ways of saying, from the very beginning, you have been a wicked, rebellious people. And so that surrounds this entire section on the golden calf. And again, kind of tells us that this is something of a single unit of thought. And then there'll be a few other examples that he mentions as well that we'll talk about in verses 22 through 24. Really, the golden calf is 7 through 21, and then the other examples are 22 through 24. And those other examples, you know, the golden calf is given first because it is kind of the quintessential example of them being rebellious from the very beginning. And then the other examples mentioned briefly show that that wasn't, you know, some momentary lapse. That was a consistent behavioral pattern in these people, which again reminds us that it's not their righteousness that merited them taking the land. In fact, their wickedness merited destruction for themselves. The very fact that they're still alive on the edge of the promised land, let alone about to take possession of it, is proof of God's mercy toward them. Throughout all the midst of this. And three things in particular show up throughout this chapter. So as we read it, keep an ear open for these ideas. They don't show up words exactly, but the stubbornness of the people is repeated several times. The provocation of the people provoking God is mentioned several times. And the rebellion of the people is mentioned several times. Altogether, those three ideas in verses 6 through 24 show up about 10 times, either one or the other, or sometimes paired up with each other. So we'll take a minute to read through 7 through 21, which again is the golden calf section. Remember, and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness from the day that you came up out of the land of Egypt until you came to this place. You have been rebellious against the Lord. Even at Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath, and the Lord was so angry with you that he was ready to destroy you. When I went up the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant that the Lord made with you, I remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. And the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them were all the words that the Lord had spoken with you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. At the end of the 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, "Arise, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you have brought from Egypt have acted corruptly. They've turned aside and out of the way that I commanded them. They've made themselves a metal image. Furthermore, the Lord said to me, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stubborn people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven. And I will make of you a nation mightier and greater than they." So I turned and came down from the mountain, and the mountain was burning with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against the Lord your God. You had made yourselves a golden calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way that the Lord had commanded you. So I took hold of the two tablets and threw them out of my hands and broke them before your eyes. Then I lay prostrate before the Lord as before, 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all the sin that you committed in doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure of the Lord that the Lord bore against you, so that he was ready to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me that time also. And the Lord was so angry with Aaron that he was ready to destroy him. And I prayed for Aaron also at the same time. Then I took the sinful thing, the calf that you had made, and burned it with fire and crushed it, grinding it very small until it was as fine as dust. And I threw the dust of it into the brook that ran down from the mountain. And we'll stop there for now. So Moses is going up the mountain to receive the two tablets of stone. And what you are to envision here is not, you know, commandments 1 through 5 on one and commandments, you know, 6 through 10 on the other, which is kind of our idea, but duplicate copies of the same thing. Again, in ancient Near Eastern covenant situations, there were two copies made, one for each party, that were kept in the house of the God of those people. And that's what's going on here. God has his copy and Moses has his copy, and it's a way of binding them together in this covenant relationship. And they're both going to be kept in the Ark of the Covenant. Ultimately, the temple is where it's going to be. So the terms of the covenant had been revealed. The people had committed themselves to the covenant. All of this is back in Exodus 24. The ratification ritual of the covenant had been completed. The covenant meal celebrating the initiation of the covenant and the new relationship had been eaten in the presence of God. All that was left was the documentation of the words of the covenant. That's all there was left to this entire thing. Every step of the covenant process had happened except getting it in writing. And Moses is going up the mountain to get it in writing, and this happens in the midst of this. And God is so angry that he is ready to destroy them. And notice God's response in verse 12 in particular. We don't have time today to talk about all the details of all of this, but verse 12 is particularly striking. Arise, go down quickly from here, for your people, whom you have brought up from Egypt, have acted corruptly. You catch that, right? Who have they been up to this point? God's people is who they have been. And now God's like, your people, Moses. It's kind of like, you know, when one parent says to the other, do you know what your son did today? Except it's a whole lot more serious than that. Because God is disowning them is what he is doing. You remember in Hosea, the names of Hosea's children and what they symbolize, or maybe you don't, but one of them is named Lo-Ami, which means not my people. And they had so broken the covenant, they are not my people. And that's not the end of the story in Hosea, of course, but that's where they stood at that point. This is the same thing. God is saying in no uncertain terms, they are not my people. They are so much not his people that he says, I will destroy them and start all over with you, which repudiates the covenant not just back to the Exodus generation, but all the way back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Or at least back to Jacob in cutting off things with Judah and restarting with Moses through the line of Levi. But it sounds like a complete, you know, it's the flood scene all over again. He's wiping out everything and starting all over with one person is kind of the idea. And Moses' response is just as serious. You know, you get these sorts of ridiculous notions of what's happening with the covenant being broken. You know, I'm trying to remember if I saw this in like some kid's book or in a cartoon or something, but the idea that Moses comes down, he's just so shocked, and he just drops the covenant, and they break, and it's just like this grand accident. Or Moses just getting so angry, he starts throwing things and smashing them like, you know, the Hulk or something. I don't know what people are thinking. And honestly, I didn't know what to expect. My thought for a lot of my life was, man, he just brought a whole lot of more work on himself to have to remake those things. Why didn't he just, you know, set them down gently and start lecturing them? Well, what Moses is doing is symbolizing what God had said. God has said, you are not my people. And Moses is destroying the objects that ratify the covenant. These are the documents that prove they are in a covenant relationship. This is the ancient equivalent of taking your contract that you have with an employer or an employee or someone that's doing work for you and tearing it up. That's what Moses is doing. He is destroying this symbol of the covenant. And it was not only symbolic of breaking the covenant. In some cultures in the ancient world, it was a legal way of showing that a covenant was broken as well. So this isn't just fly off the handle anger. It's certainly not an accident. What he's doing is showing them what God had said to him, which is, you are no longer my people. This covenant relationship is over. And of course, that's not going to be the end of the story, but that's where things stood right then between them and God. And so he breaks the tablets, he burns the calf, and you might remember that he tells them back in chapter 7:25, when they go into the land, the carved images of their gods you shall burn with fire. So he does that himself to the golden calf, and he washes it out of their midst in this stream. Exodus tells us that he makes them drink the water as well. But apparently there was a stream running down the mountain, and the ashes and the remnants get thrown into that, where it is swept away from them. Whatever bit of it that they drink as well as it's running through the stream. The smallest remnants possible of this idol are destroyed beyond any possibility of recovery or reuse whatsoever by the time it's done. They've either ingested little bits of it, or it has been washed away completely, and it is gone. And then the other piece of it is that Moses makes intercession for Aaron as well, which this is the only place that shows up. It is not in the book of Exodus that he has to make intercession for Aaron. So this is added here, and it's a fitting place to add this detail. It's really not especially relevant to the story of Exodus that God is so angry with Aaron that he wants to destroy him, and Moses makes intercession there. It is relevant here. And the reason why it's relevant is that it tells us that not only you people in general were so wicked that God wanted to destroy you, but your high priest, your very first high priest, who is, you know, something of the model of every high priest after that, and it must be in his line that every other high priest comes, he is so wicked that God wanted to destroy him as well. He was that unholy as to be in danger of destruction. And this word destruction and possession and dispossession that show up all through this chapter, these words are all words that God has been using of the Canaanites consistently as well, up to this point in Deuteronomy. And so he is doing to them, again, what they're supposed to be doing to the Canaanites. Now, the passing reference here to "I made intercession for you and the Lord listened to me that time also," that's going to be talked about in more detail in verse 25 and following. Here, it's kind of running through the basic story, and then he'll come back to the intercession itself, and so we're going to save that for just a few moments. But any thoughts on 7 through 21 and the retelling of the golden calf? Well, I think some of it in this instance is a bit more obvious in the golden calf incident, because there are two ways of looking at it, and it's hard to know exactly what's going on. It seems to me, as I read it, particularly in Exodus, that what they're looking for is a visual representation of God, which is to make a graven image of God. And if they're not doing that, then they're coming up with a new God. And either way, you're in that first commandment realm, which is so obviously against everything God wants. And so that seems to be the driving force here. And so what I would say is, you know, to avoid this kind of provoking of God, a lot of it comes down to remembering who God is, and not making gods of other things, and not making God something less than he is, which one or the two or both of those are what they're doing here specifically. What are the thoughts here? All right, well, the other examples that are given here are throughout the wilderness period, and they're given in very short order. He just kind of gives them by the name that they've been given, and all of those names are, or three of the four at least, the names themselves mean something about what happened there. So at Taberah also, and at Massah, and at Kibroth Hataavah, you provoked the Lord to wrath. And so these three places, Taberah means burning, And this is a reference back to Numbers chapter 11, where they complained about their misfortunes, and God had enough, and the fire of the Lord came and destroyed some of them until Moses interceded for them there. Massa is the place of testing that shows up several times. Meribah and Massa that show up in various places throughout the Bible. Here, Massa again means testing. It's Exodus chapter 17, where again this is something of a quintessential point of rebellion based on how frequently it's used after that. Kibroth Hata'ava means graves of craving. And this story actually begins earlier. It begins closer to verses 4 or 5. 31 through 34 of Numbers 11 is kind of where it's coming to a head. This is where they complain about the manna. We remember the great food that we had back in Egypt, that passage. And ultimately what it leads to is God sending two things, quail and a plague. And several of them die because of their craving. And so it was called the place of the graves of craving. And so those three are just mentioned in short order, but all of them would have known exactly what those places were and what they meant by the names themselves. And when the Lord sent you up at Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and take possession of the land that I have given you, then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God and did not believe him or obey his voice. You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. So Kadesh Barnea, and we've talked about that at some length. That's what Moses spends a large chunk of chapter 1 talking about, was their rebellion at Kadesh Barnea. And so he's talked about this already. He's bringing it up again. We don't need to talk through all of that. But this is where they reject the promised land and get sent back into the wilderness then. So that's the last examples. And again, they're pretty rapid fire there. There's not a whole lot to say about them unless we want to go back and look at every single text in detail. Guy? Yes. Yeah, I think those are the words of Moses. From the very beginning, since I knew you, you've been rebellious completely. And it's his words, too, back in verse 7, from the day you came out of the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you've been rebellious against the day of the Lord. And Moses kind of brackets this section of this rebuttal of their righteousness. You know, you think because we're so righteous we're taking the land. Well, from the very beginning you've been rebellious. And he begins and ends this section detailing their rebellion, their constant rebellion, with that statement from the very beginning. Ever since I knew you, it's been this way. Charlie? Let's hold off on that until we talk about Moses as an intercessor, because we're going to get a chunk on that here in verses 25 through 29, and I think there may be some things in that discussion that'll kind of help with the other situations as well. I'm not avoiding it, though. Greg?
Yeah, if you're going to be doing the intercessor thing, it's good. But I just think it's an interesting contrast between Moses and Israel, and then this little verse in the middle here that says you didn't believe him or listen to his voice.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, basically summarizes the difference between Moses and Israelites.
Right. All right, well, I'm gonna kind of run through. We're going to come back to Moses' intercession, because that's going to be the biggest thing that we've got left to talk about in some detail, and it's the kind of thing that it's surely going to prompt questions that I don't know how well I can answer, but we'll come back to that in just a second. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 5 is the covenant being renewed, the new tablets of stone being made like the first ones. And so the covenant was torn up, so to speak. The contract was torn up, but God has forgiven them now. And new tablets of stone are made to symbolize the covenant has been restored. In verses 1 through 5, they're going to be placed in the ark. Here it's an ark, not the ark. It's going to become the ark at a later point, but the ark of the covenant is going to be made by these divinely endowed craftsmen at a later point. So this is just an ark for them to be stored in at this point. Then verses 10 and 11 are the renewal of the journey. And so the tablets are remade and they go on their journey again, which is kind of another way of, again, symbolizing things are back to normal, things are okay, they're doing what God wants them to do. Then verses 6 through 9 are something of a parenthetical, and some translations even mark it off as a parenthetical, in fact, because it's kind of an elaboration on Aaron and the Levites, and again, that things were okay there as well is kind of the idea. But if you notice, if you skip 6 through 9, so you're reading along verse 5, "Then I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the ark that I had made, and there they are as the Lord commanded me." Verse 10, "I myself stayed on the mountain as at the first time, 40 days and 40 nights, and the Lord listened to me this time also. The Lord was unwilling to destroy you." It reads nice and smoothly from verse 5 to verse 10 without that section in between, and then verses 6 through 9 seem to be a little bit disjointed. And so what a lot of people believe is that this was, you remember how we talked about Deuteronomy being having a Mosaic core, but not everything in Deuteronomy was written by Moses because there are things that are clearly after him. Some have suggested that this is a later addition. But whether it is or not, the point here again is the people are journeying on, the Aaronic priesthood is continuing, and the Levitical work of the Levites, of course, is continuing on as well. So all of this is kind of business back to usual on the heels of Moses' intercession. And that's significant because Moses' intercession does not end with the statement, "And because of Moses' prayer, the Lord forgave them." It doesn't have any statement of God's reaction. And so these statements, the covenant is restored, the tablets are re-engraved, the priests are going about their work, the Aaronic priesthood is continuing, and they're restarting their journey back to the promised land. This is all ways of saying that Moses' prayer worked and God has forgiven them. But it's more implied, and it's, you know, seeing it as obviously being what happened on the basis of their actions. But Moses' intercessory prayer is the most interesting piece of all of this, and I've saved about 3 minutes for it, and that's to avoid questions that I can't answer. So, now we've talked about some of this before at various times, so I lay prostrate before the Lord for these 40 days and 40 nights because the Lord said that he would destroy you, and I prayed to the Lord. Now listen, O Lord God, do not destroy your people and your heritage, whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. So what is Moses responding to? God's promises on the one hand, but what did I hear somewhere else?
Your people.
God has said, your people whom you brought out of Egypt. And Moses says, no, God, they're your people whom you have brought out of Egypt. And then this is where it's going to end as well. So this is another one of those bracketing things to begin and end this. So in verse 26, do not destroy your people and your heritage. Verse 29, for they are your people and your heritage whom you brought out by your great power and by your outstretched arm. And so he basically says to God, no, God, you're wrong. They're your people. They're not my people. Now, I don't know if he would have said it in quite that tone or quite that bluntly, but he is kind of saying it that bluntly in direct response to what God had told him about them being his people. Moses says, no, they're your people. Then he says, secondly, remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do not regard the stubbornness of this people or their wickedness or their sin, lest the land from which you brought us say, because the Lord was not able to bring them into the land that he promised them, and because he hated them, he brought them out into the wilderness to put them to death. And so there are three things, really, that are the foundation of Moses' appeal. First of all, they're God's people. Secondly, remember God's promises. And then thirdly, remember God's name, God's jealousy for his own name and his own glory, and what are the people going to say about him if he is unable or unwilling to keep his promises. They surely wouldn't understand. And so the statements back up in verse 19, and then also then down in chapter 10 and verse 10, the Lord listened to me this time. What do we do with this kind of language? What do we do with the fact that God says, I'm going to disavow all of my previous promises and start over with you, Moses? What do we do with the fact that God says, I'm going to destroy them, and Moses talks him out of it? What do we do with all of that kind of language? Well, again, I don't know that I have the answer to all of those things in particular, but notice back up in verse 14, God says to Moses, leave me alone so that I may destroy them. That's a striking thing for God to say. Does God have to say that? Leave me alone so I can destroy them. Does God need Moses' permission to destroy the Israelites? No, he doesn't. Of course not. So why does God say to Moses, leave me alone so that I can destroy them? To prompt him. I think this is an invitation to Moses to make this kind of appeal. It's similar, I think, to what he does with Abraham back in Genesis chapter 18. I'm going down to investigate the cities of the plain to see just how wicked they are. Does he have to tell Abraham that? He's inviting him into this conversation to make this very kind of intercession. God doesn't just allow people to intercede in prayer. He invites people to intercede in prayer. And in later biblical texts, he will command people to intercede in prayer. And somehow, in a way that I don't think we will ever really be able to fathom, he works all of that into the decision-making process of the heavenly council. How does that work? I have no idea. I'm not even going to begin to try to answer it. But that is the constant biblical picture, is that he invites intercession, and that has some impact of some kind, one way or another. And this, I think, is the great paradox of God listening to Moses. Because what is Moses saying, really? He's appealing to God to change. But in the final analysis, the change that he is appealing toward is asking God to be consistent to his promises. I want you to change by being the same, is what it amounts to. Be steadfast to what you have said, to be consistent with who you are. And that's clearer in Numbers, where he quotes God's revelation of his character back to him in the prayer as well. I'm asking you to be who you are. I'm asking you to be true to your promises that you have made. So change by being the same is really what it amounts to. And this, I think, may be something of a clue to how this kind of intercessory prayer is supposed to work. We're not asking God to change who he is. We're asking God to be the same to who he is, really, in one way or another. And so it's not from our anxiety about God that we pray intercessory prayers, but it's about God's commitment to his relationship with us. And there is this kind of dissonance that's working itself out, but it's the dissonance between God is a God of boundless love and a world that is completely unlovely. It's the dissonance between God's covenant faithfulness and a people that are unfaithful to their side of the covenant. That's the dissonance, not between anything that God is himself one way or another. And so I don't know if that answers any questions or if that brings up more questions than it can possibly answer, but I think that's maybe something of a helpful way of thinking about this and maybe goes towards something of the question that Charlie was asking earlier, in particular this paradox of asking God to change by asking him to remain the same, being something of a driving force behind this. So I'm past time, but I know that opens up a whole bunch of multiple cans of worms. So we'll take a couple questions or comments here. Brian, were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to say there could also be a benefit for God saying this to put a big amount of fear into the people. That, hey, God was so angry with you that he could destroy you. I mean, it's just like, you know, if I hear I did something wrong and my dad was so mad at me that he was going to, you know, kick me out of the house. And, oh, wow, I better straighten up.
Okay.
It's kind of the same.
Yeah, so it could have a rhetorical impact beyond just it being an actual promise that what God was going to do. Greg? Right, and that's, you know, what I've not emphasized, except that it's been on the top of every slide, is this entire section is about God's grace. That it is God's grace that brings them to the point that they are now. It is God's mercy that is why they're even alive. It has nothing to do with their righteousness and everything to do with God's grace. All right, well, we'll stop there a little bit too late and continue on in verse 11 of chapter 10 on Sunday morning, afternoon.